Part 2. Genitals. Chapter 5. Cover-up. Hidden behind the walls of a monastery in the small Italian town of Bassano Romano is one of the most sensational sculptures in the history of Western art. In the monastery's church of San Vincenzo Martire, tucked away inside a tiny sacristy, is the Risen Christ, a masterpiece of Renaissance spirituality hewn from creamy marble by Michelangelo. Christ stands almost 7 feet tall, holding upright the large, heavy cross on which he was killed. He leans casually into the cross, his strong arms comfortably bearing its bulk. Bundled in one hand are the accessories of his execution, a rope thickly coiled, and the sponge used to wet his drying, dying lips. From his other hand dangles his abandoned death shroud. His face is turned away from the cross as he gazes down at the new world his resurrection has created. His burly body is athletically taut, recalling the classical statuary of Greek culture so beloved by the artist and his contemporaries. Like his Greek forebears, the risen Christ of Bassano Romano is confidently, magnificently nude. Beneath a tidy crescent of pubic hair, his petite, relaxed penis rests on a fleshy, rounded scrotum. Jesus' genitals are unashamedly displayed. The statue was largely ignored until the art world rediscovered it in 1997, which swiftly led to its identification as Michelangelo's first attempt at this particular composition. Commissioned in 1514 for the Church of Santa Maria sopra Minerva in Rome, the statue had disappeared from public view when the artist abandoned his nearly completed creation upon discovering a long dark vein in the marble disfiguring the face of Christ. He began again with a fresh block of stone, and it's this second version that still stands in its intended home in Rome. It too is a nude Christ, or at least it was, until a gaudy bronze loincloth was fixed to the statue in 1546, veiling the penis and testicles from view. Tarnished with age, the modesty device remains to this day. So too do the fluttering draperies and flimsy breeches painted in 1565 over the genitals and buttocks of the writhing nude figures populating Michelangelo's monumental Last Judgment, 1534-42, in the Sistine Chapel. All those figures showing their nakedness so shamelessly, the papal master of ceremonies, Biagio de Cesena, is reported to have exclaimed upon seeing the enormous fresco as it neared completion. The poet Pietro Aretino was equally appalled. "Your art would be at home in some voluptuous bagnino, or brothel, certainly not in the highest chapel of the world," he wrote to Michelangelo in 1545. "Less criminal were it if you were an infidel than being a believer, thus to sap the faith of others." The censoring of Michelangelo's work was just one of a number of counter-reformation strategies appointed by bishops, priests, and theologians in the wake of the Council of Trent, 1545-63, to tackle what had come to be seen as the scandalous profanity of frontal nudity in Christian art. No matter that Michelangelo, like many of his predecessors and peers, used the nude theologically to celebrate the humanity and masculinity of the divine Christ. For too many, the genitals were both spiritually and morally dangerous and were thus to be hidden from view. This was far from a new idea. The genitals have long functioned as a site of religious and cultural anxiety in human societies. Simultaneously associated with sex, reproduction, and urination, the places and spaces between our legs trigger deep-rooted social and cultural concerns, particularly about their public display, and are coded with values and meanings in ways many other body parts are not. These values and meanings are closely linked to the generative and changeable physiology of our genitals. After all, they're places of potent physical transformation. Pubic hair grows, grays, and fades as we age. Vaginas open, expand, and contract during sex and in labour, and are the entry and exit points at which new life is brought into the world. Penises alternate from small and soft to large and hard as erections come and go. Scrotums, labia, and clitorises similarly enlarge and engorge and shrink and retreat at the stimulus of touch and temperature. Genital skin is recurrently moistened and scented by the body's natural lubricants and the wetness of sexual arousal, or by menstruation, ejaculation, and the expulsion of urine. Our genitals are subject to changes in appearance, touch, smell, function, and form more than any other part of our bodies. They're powerfully transformative. And like other manifestations of power and transformation, they are potentially dangerous unless carefully harnessed or managed by the social and cultural preferences of the communities in which we live. It's for this reason that human societies past and present at once celebrate and denigrate the genitals. Some cultures might decorate, cut, pierce, cover, or expose the genitals of certain groups. In some societies, people might find themselves temporarily or permanently maligned or marginalised given the relative status of their genitalia. Menstruating women, the impotent, the infertile, the sick, those who are intersex or those who are transgender. But it's the covering of the sexual organs that's the most common form of genital regulation in human societies. In the modern West, as in many other cultures, an adult's genitals are to be covered most of the time. Their uncovering in social settings tends to occur only in certain circumstances, during sex with someone else, in a medical context, or when the social norms surrounding the exposure of the genitals are deliberately flouted, whether subversively, pornographically, or abusively. Our genitals have become our private parts, and yet they remain socially powerful. What we do with our genitalia, and how we do it, where we do it, and with whom, is inextricably linked to the identity politics and associated power play of wider society. From shifting ideas about gender, sexuality, appearance, and dress, to nebulous concepts as varied as virginity, adulthood, status, and decency, our genitals are in many ways public property, at once privileged and protected, feared and shamed. By covering our genitals, we render them culturally visible. In the West, our complicated relationship with our genitals has been heavily shaped by the fallout from the most famous of cover-ups, the donning of fig leaves in the Garden of Eden. The story is told in the book of Genesis, in which Eve takes fruit from a forbidden tree and gives it to Adam. They eat, and the eyes of the first man and woman are pointedly said to be opened. They suddenly perceive their bodies differently. They're not simply bare, but undressed. Adam and Eve sew fig leaves together to make coverings to fix around their waists and further conceal their bodies in the foliage of the garden when they hear God approaching. Having cursed them for their disobedience with a promise of hard agricultural and maternal labour, God expels them from Eden. In the hands of early Christian theologians, this story about human misbehaviour became a morality tale about the dangers of the flesh. They turned their eyes on their own genitals and lusted after them with that stirring movement they'd not previously known, conjectured the 5th century CE bishop Augustine of Hippo, a Christian convert and reformed womanizer who knew the hazardous allures of the body all too well. His formulation of humanity's original sin would quickly become a central doctrine of the Western Church. Eve became a temptress who led her husband into religious deviancy. Transgression led to sexualization, rendering innocent nudity shameful nakedness. The first humans fell away from God, exchanging the easy intimacy of the garden for the sweat, pain, and unruly sexual desire of the carnal world. Salvation from original sin, congenitally inherited by all humans, was only to be found in Christ, the celibate, sinless counterpart to Adam, who was birthed into the world by Mary, the virginal, uncorrupted foil to Eve. Woeful shame and dangerous lust have infected our genitals ever since. And yet there's nothing in the biblical story of Eden to suggest that the covering of the genitals reflects the sin of sexuality. Rather, it's a tale about the disobedience of Adam and Eve and the threat that they now pose to God, who shares with his divine colleagues in the heavenly council his worry that, in acquiring wisdom, the humans have become like one of us. They're akin to gods. Their rudimentary clothing marks this transformed, elevated status, a new status further acknowledged by God himself, who replaces their flimsy fig leaves with more durable outfits of leather made by his own hand. Beyond the bounds of the garden, humans immediately harness their newfound wisdom to do as the gods have always done. They bear children, cultivate crops and rear animals. They kill, travel, play music, build cities, forge tools, craft weapons, and perform rituals. In covering their genitals, Adam and Eve reveal not their sexualized self-corruption, but their godlike capacity for the creation of culture. The distortion of this story by early theologians is just one episode in the long history of a ferocious Christian hostility towards sex and the genitals. It was a hostility shaped in part by the acute ascetic tendencies of certain ancient and classical Greek philosophies, including aspects of Stoicism and Platonism, in which the base and the bodily were sharply distinguished from the sublime and the immaterial. But it was also a view firmly embedded within the earliest authoritative writings of Christianity. In his letter to Christian communities in Roman Galatia, in what's now Turkey, the self-declared Apostle Paul draws a pointed distinction between the carnal and the divine. "Live by the Spirit, I say, and do not gratify the desires of the flesh, for what the flesh desires is opposed to the Spirit, and what the Spirit desires is opposed to the flesh." For those unwilling or unable to renounce sex, as he told Christians in Corinth, it was better to marry as a means of containing passion, lest the body became so aflame that all self-control would be lost. For Paul, an out and proud celibate himself, the holy and the horny could not and should not mix. It was an austere asceticism seemingly endorsed by Christ himself in texts circulating among early Christian communities across Southwest Asia, the Mediterranean, and North Africa, including the Gospels, which date from the latter half of the 1st century CE. Here, Jesus often appears as an extremist who opposes traditional forms of household kinship and its sexual dynamics. He frequently undermines the social worth of marriage and childbirth in favour of an androcentric model of family in which male believers are bound together by faith, not blood. "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even life itself, cannot be my disciple." Although he strongly condemns adultery, divorce and remarriage, the Jesus of the New Testament Gospels presents marriage and childbirth, and by strong implication, sex itself, as a relic of a former age of spiritual ignorance that his death and resurrection would destroy. By the 2nd century CE, this hostility had intensified. In an important text known as the Acts of Thomas, the risen Jesus suddenly appears in the bedchamber of a couple on their wedding night, urging them not to have sex. "Know that if you refrain from this filthy intercourse, you become temples holy and pure, and you will not be involved in the cares of life and of children, whose end is destruction." Suffer little children indeed. Meanwhile, in the Gospel of Thomas, another influential work, Jesus goes further, casting childlessness as a divine blessing. "The days will come when you will say, 'Blessed is the womb which has not conceived and the breasts which have not given suck.'" The conception and raising of children was not only considered a distracting impediment to believers, but a salvific irrelevance. According to Luke's Gospel, Jesus had warned of the futility of sexual reproduction because disaster was coming. "Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days, for there'll be great distress on the earth and wrath against this people." Indeed, many early Christians, including Paul and the Gospel writers, believed that the world as they knew it was about to end, for it was to be swept away by the kingdom of God, in which there'd be no place for sex, nor need for procreation. Instead, believers would enjoy eternal life in celibate, heavenly bodies akin to those of angels. The world didn't come to an end. Yet neither did Christianity die with its first followers. Unsurprisingly, early Christian sex advice appears not to have been wildly popular, for believers continued having children. Although virginity and celibacy would long be idealised as the pious behaviour of the most devout, Christian teaching on marriage and procreation quickly became more accommodating to sexual reproduction, drawing closer to the traditional values of mainstream Jewish groups, for whom marital sex had long been lauded as a pleasurable activity essential to the religious well-being of both husband and wife and the flourishing of the family. Indeed, sex in marriage was commanded in the Torah by God himself, who had insisted that a newly married man must remain at home for a year in order to give pleasure to his wife. By the 2nd century CE, some Jewish laws were stipulating that a man must have sex with his wife at least once a week and seek her permission before taking a job that would require prolonged absences from the marital bed. Against this cultural backdrop, however, sexual activities beyond the bounds of marriage, including adultery, prostitution, and same-sex relationships, were deemed antisocial and religiously deviant by both early Jewish and Christian leaders. These activities undermined or upturned the building blocks of marriage, household, kinship, and inheritance on which society was constructed. Sexual deviancy was consequently considered offensive to God, for it was contrary to his intentions for humanity. As authoritatively depicted in the first chapter of Genesis, sex was cast as a human activity commanded by God and yet distanced from him. Set within a cosmic framework of divine creation, its primary purpose was to fulfill God's life-giving instruction that humans be fruitful and multiply, a blessing issued at the point of humanity's creation. The birthing of children was closely tied to the mortality of every generation. Humanity could only continue to exist by reproducing, setting them apart from their Creator, for whom existence was perpetual. God thus neither needed nor desired sex. Despite the divine blessing of sex within marriage, an inherent opposition of the sexualized body and the divine was deeply embedded within ancient Jewish and Christian cultures. To a certain extent, it was already modelled in the very language of the scriptures themselves, in which references to the sexualized body were euphemistically controlled or poetically presented. In keeping with long-established cultural norms across ancient Southwest Asia, the vocabulary used in literature to describe or refer to the genitals tended towards the colloquial, euphemism, allusion, and wordplay. Common linguistic strategies to describe the sex organs included concrete terms for tools and weapons for male genitals, bow, arrow, staff, rod, plough, and domestic or horticultural language for female genitals, water well, churn, field, garden, fruit. Other body parts frequently served as stand-ins for the genitals, particularly hand, thigh, limb, flesh for the penis, lips and mouth for the vulva, and feet for the genitals of any type of body. Abstractions, too, were especially common for male sex organs. Nakedness, strength, and virility are all frequently attested. These linguistic tics are arguably a reflex of common cultural anxieties surrounding the sexual organs, a reflex similarly pervading modern societies. Both British and North American English, for example, enjoy a rich spread of genital vocabulary, from the formal, penis, testicles, vulva, vagina, and the politely veiled, privates, bits, John Thomas, lady garden, to the childish, willy, winky, foo-foo, vajayjay, and also the vulgar, cock, prick, pussy, cunt, gash. But in ancient Southwest Asian cultures, The literary veiling of the genitals did not render the sexualized body invisible. On the contrary, the elasticity of euphemism made room for deeply erotic reflections on the sexualized body. Take, for example, this sensuous description of bodies readying themselves for sex, in which the wetness of male and female arousal is played out in a flirtatious fantasy. I was sleeping, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I've taken off my robe. Am I to put it on again? I've bathed my feet. Am I to get them dirty? My lover reached his hand into the opening, at which my body thrilled. I rose to open to my lover, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers flowing myrrh on the handles of the bolt. This beautiful love lyric appears in the Bible. It's an extract from the Song of Songs, chapter 5, verses 2 to 5, a Hellenistic compilation of older meditations on the pain and pleasure of sexual desire, a compilation that was so beloved of the scribal cultures of ancient Jerusalem that it found its way into the canonical collections of both Judaism and Christianity. But as the authority of certain religious texts grew, including the Song of Songs, colloquial and euphemistic words for the genitals acquired an additional veneer of reverential modesty. Both early Jewish and Christian interpretations of biblical literature increasingly privileged the metaphorical and abstract over the poetic and corporeal, effectively distancing the sacred from the all too human realities of sex. What had come to be understood as the written word of God could not be tainted by the gauche, seductive, or scandalous intrusion of genital language. It was a theological tendency encouraged by the careful separation of the sexualized human body from the divine, which had long been expressed in the Torah and other early Jewish texts in the form of strict ritual regulations surrounding mortals' encounters with sacred space. Scholars are unsure of the extent to which these restrictive regulations were imposed and obeyed, but they indicate nonetheless deep anxiety about the management of human genitals in religious contexts, and carefully managed they were. Just as priests were instructed to remove their shoes and wash their feet before entering the house of God, so too they were ordered to ensure not only that their genitals were covered, but that beneath their long tunics, penises and testicles were tightly secured with close-fitting, high-quality linen underpants, which effectively neutralized and symbolically neutered the sexualized bodies of priests. Uncontrolled, loose genitals were clearly not appropriate in the presence of God. Worse still were leaky genitals, which were considered ritually toxic. According to the book of Leviticus, men who had recently ejaculated or women who had recently had sex were considered unclean or impure. In other words, they were unfit for ritual activity, posing a danger both to the sanctity of sacred space and to its personnel. Consequently, these men and women were not to approach such space until they had performed a day-long purification ceremony at home. Menstruating women, or those bleeding after childbirth, were even more dangerous, demanding not only extended periods of ritual purification of at least a week, but also the day-long purification of anyone who might come into contact with them or the items their bodies had touched. Similar strategies were also employed to deal with anyone suffering a genital discharge prompted by infection or illness. Even after the final destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 CE, these regulations and the rabbinic debates they sparked remained potent within Jewish worship, impacting synagogue and study house attendance for both men and women. Jewish concerns about the genitals were inevitably carried into early Christian worship and its liturgical precepts. Encouraged by the pro-celibacy theology of salvation promoted by Paul and other prominent community leaders, early Christians of both Jewish and Gentile cultural identity shared and squabbled over anxieties about the potential religious hazards of their genitals. As the small house cults of earliest Christian meetings gave way to more formalized, public, and increasingly sacred venues of worship, restrictions triggered by the sexualized body intensified. Long before infant baptism became a Christian norm, baptism as an initiation into the faith was originally more akin to a spiritual coming-of-age ritual for adults, and in some communities, it was undertaken either wholly undressed or nearly so, in order to ensure the holy water thoroughly coated the body. But this set the sexually mature body and the anxieties it provoked at the very heart of believers' most sacred rites. The transformative power of baptism likely addressed some of these anxieties, as a stunning 6th century mosaic set into the ceiling of the Arian Baptistry in Ravenna, Italy, would later attest. Flanked by John the Baptist and the god of the Jordan River, an adolescent Jesus is immersed up to his waist in the river waters. He's completely naked and his genitals are clearly visible. Beardless and youthful, this striking image of Jesus points to the notion of a sin-free nudity, akin to that originally enjoyed by Adam and Eve in Eden. But while childlike nakedness or partial nudity in baptism had been variously encouraged or idealized in the earlier centuries of Christianity, discomfort with the exposed or undressed body steadily grew. These anxieties centered as much around issues of identity and difference as they did theological worries concerning the raw exposure of the flesh, so that Christians increasingly sought to distinguish their immersion rituals from those of traditional Jewish practice, as well as the bathing cultures of Greco-Roman civic life, in which nudity or partial nudity was more usual. Just as significantly, naked baptism would also trigger wider concerns about the ritual roles of women. Some early Christian women likely self-administered baptism in small, private groups to maintain bodily privacy and spare male blushes. But many feared women had been granted too much ritual power in the performance of what remains one of Christianity's most important sacraments. As churches spread and their membership diversified, apostolic authority birthed powerful priesthoods, rendering baptisms more public, ceremonial, and heavily regulated. Male priests now baptized both men and women, and so genitals and buttocks were hastily hidden. For most early Christian communities, however, it was the actively polluting nature of the female sex organs and the ritual risks inherent in the aftermath of male ejaculation that proved most problematic. Some groups forbade menstruating and postpartum women both from baptism and Eucharist, while in many communities, the temporary exclusion of women who had recently given birth from all forms of worship would eventually be extended in the more common rite of churching. In many churches, leaders advised any man or woman who'd recently been exposed to semen to delay their participation in worship, whether private prayer or communal celebration. Even the impact of a wet dream upon a man's ability to draw closer to Christ in worship was a point of contention in the first centuries of the faith. Understood as an involuntary ejaculation, prompted by latent lust or demonic stimulation, a wet dream muddied the growing convention surrounding the careful religious management of the sexualized body. Some considered it an unwilling, if unseemly, omission that should not impinge upon spiritual development and acceptance by Christ. For others, however, it was a devilish sign of the weak and corruptive flesh and demanded immediate rectification by means of penitence or temporary exclusion from worship. Even in sleep, the genitals were dangerous. Despite the differences within and between early Jewish and Christian communities, all appeared to agree that the regulation of the genitals hinged around perceptions of sacred time and sacred place. Priests, rabbis, and worshippers alike were duty-bound to ensure their sex organs were in the right state at the right time before entering into the presence of God. Essentially, genitals were to be considered an aspect of the human condition, not the divine. And yet the body of the God of the Bible suggests otherwise. Cocksure exposure. It was in the 30th year of his life, in the fourth month of that year, and on the fifth day of that month, says the Jerusalem priest Ezekiel ben Busi, that he saw God. Like most ritual specialists, Ezekiel appears to have been a stickler for precision. After all, the timing, placement, and properties of religious ceremonies were not simply the routines of tradition, but the magical mechanics by which the divine realm was accessed. Despite his exile to Nippur in Babylonia following the conquest of Judah in 597 BCE, this Jerusalem temple priest nonetheless retained his eye for detail. In the opening chapter of the biblical book bearing his name, Ezekiel describes his vision of God in sumptuous, if at times baffling, detail. He sees a large dark cloud enveloped by flashes of fire, with a shining brightness emanating from within. Inside the cloud are four giant cherubim, the enormous hybrid beings who accompany the deity. Each one has four faces, one human, one leonine, one bovine, and one like an eagle. He describes their legs, straight, their feet, bronzed hooves, and their wings, four each, with human hands attached, which create a thundering rumble as they move. Above the cherubim, he sees a wheeled, mobile throne of lapis lazuli, upon which is seated a figure whose form is like a human being. It's God. He's rolled himself out of Jerusalem on his throne to join his priest in Babylonia. As Ezekiel describes God, he knows exactly where to look and what to say, or rather, where to look and what not to say. His gaze sweeps up and down God's body, but he no longer describes precisely what he sees. Instead, he veils the deity in the religious language of glorious, mysterious spectacle. Upward from what looked to be his Motnaim, I saw it sparkling like amber. It seemed to be enveloped all around by fire. And from his Motnaim downward, I saw something like fire and brilliance surrounded him. Like the bow in a cloud on a rainy day, this was the appearance of the brilliance all around. This enigmatic language is a canny, priestly distancing device, designed to reverently conceal the divine body from the eyes of the uninitiated. But Ezekiel leaves exposed one body part. God's Motnaim, a Hebrew term traditionally and politely rendered loins or waist, but which more accurately refers to the groin and its genitals. Ezekiel might shy away from describing God's face, his torso, his arms, legs and feet, but he openly acknowledges God's genitals, navigating his visual journey up and down the divine body by means of the godly groin. It's not only a stunning display of the graphic corporeality of God, but a theological manifestation of the distance and difference between mortals and God. If in Genesis human bodies are made culturally visible by the covering of their genitals, in Ezekiel, God's body is mysteriously, transcendently concealed by the exposure of his. Ezekiel is not the only biblical figure to acknowledge God's genitals. The prophet Isaiah is said to have had a similarly intimate encounter with the deity almost a century and a half earlier, in the mid-8th century BCE. In a scene still celebrated in Christian and Jewish prayer, Isaiah enters the inner sanctum of the Jerusalem temple and sees God enthroned. The deity is accompanied by seraphim, fiery flying serpents, each equipped with three pairs of wings. With one set, they cover their faces. With another, they cover their genitals, euphemistically described as feet. And with the other, they soar about the throne, crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The temple shakes with the sound of their voices. Its air thickens with the heady smoke of incense. The prophet was overwhelmed. "My eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts," Isaiah exclaims. "I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, tall and lofty. His lower extremities filled the temple." It's an image of divine gigantism we've come to expect. The huge throne seats a deity so large, his lower extremities cram the sanctuary. Most ancient and modern translators reverently assume it's the hem of Yahweh's great robe that swamps the space. but Isaiah makes no mention of a robe. Rather, the Hebrew term he employs to refer to the deity's lower extremities, shul, is more commonly used by biblical prophets not to refer to the edges of garments, but to pointedly allude to the fleshy realities of the sexual organs. In this vision in Isaiah, God's genitals are enormous. No wonder the seraphim coyly position their wings over their own. Like temple priests donning underpants, their covering gesture in the divine throne room acknowledges their humble stature in the presence of the well-endowed deity they praise. The scale of Yahweh's genitalia is to be expected, not only because it belongs to a supersized body, but because Yahweh's cultural father, the aged deity Ael, was similarly well-equipped. In the mythological stories enshrined on the clay tablets of cosmopolitan Ugarit, dated to about 1350 to 1200 BCE, Ael's penis makes several appearances. In one myth, the god sets out along the serpentine seashore at the edge of the world, where he encounters two young goddesses. They urge him to get an erection and take them in body in marriage. The response is unambiguous. Ael's penis grew as long as the sea. Ael's penis grew as long as the ocean. Having installed them as brides in his home, he grasps his penis in his right hand and shoots it skyward like an arrow to entice his new wives into consummating the marriage. They're suitably impressed with his masturbatory performance. Ael stoops to kiss them, relishing the pomegranate sweet taste of their lips, a delicately sensuous double entendre. Penetrative sex quickly follows, and Ael impregnates the goddesses, who bear him the gracious gods Shahar, dawn, and Shalem, dusk. Ael's penis may have enthused his young brides, but his primary wife, the great mother goddess Athirat, is not as easily impressed by his penchant for occasional genital exhibition. When she visits her husband in the Baal cycle of myths, Athirat is on a mission to secure Ael's approval for the construction of a palace for Baal. Delighted to see her, Ael assumes her needs are bodily and scrambles to sate her appetites. He offers her rich food and fine wine, and then his penis. "Does the penis of Ael the king excite you?" he says. "Does the love organ of the bull arouse you?" Ignoring both his penis and his questions, Athirat simply presses on with her petition. With the world-weary strategy goddesses were often forced to deploy, she tactfully flatters him not with sexual compliments, but appeals to his great wisdom to win her case. In this story, Ael's self-titling as bull is just as revealing as the flaunting of his penis. The bull was an enduring ancient symbol of an aggressively potent, unrestrained hyper-masculinity. It manifested military might, sexual prowess, and divine generative power. These were the qualities of the masculine gods of creation, who harnessed the wildness of chaos to impose order upon the cosmos and bring fecundity into the world. It's an ancient and sophisticated constellation of religious ideas, offering an image of a raw, animalized sexual virility that's celebrated in a Sumerian myth dated to about 2000 BCE. In this remarkably vivid tale, the high god Enki, also known as Ea, who is himself engendered by a divine bull and begotten by a wild bull, fertilizes the world by digging irrigation ditches with his penis and creating the great rivers of Mesopotamia with his semen. After Father Enki had lifted his eyes across the Euphrates, he stood up full of lust like a rampant bull, lifted his penis, ejaculated, and filled the Euphrates with flowing water. By lifting his penis, he brought a bridal gift. The tigress rejoiced in its heart like a great wild bull when it was born. In the same myth, Enki's penetrative bodily presence in the heavens, in the meadows, and in the rivers stimulates an abundance of rains, a high carp flood, and an accumulation of grains and fruits. As the god of fresh waters, Enki's semen quite literally enlivens the cosmos. It's in these phallic acts of creation that he proves himself a high god and divine progenitor par excellence. This fertile potency was a characteristic shared across millennia with other masculine deities closely associated with the bull or to whom the epithet bull was approvingly applied. These included the Egyptian god of male sexuality, Min, who was consistently depicted in art with an impressively permanent erection, the deity Amun-Ra, who frequently adopted Min's phallic iconography, and their venerable colleague Atum, a god of creation, who famously declared that, from the very beginning, he came into being ithyphallic. Alongside Ealet Ugarit, the god Baal used what's described as his tumescent penis to mate with a heifer, fathering the wild bull who impregnated the city's cattle. The Assyrian storm god Adad was often depicted standing atop a great bull, while various unidentified goddesses across the region are depicted upon a divine bull, commanding its virility, an image seemingly recast and abased in the famous Greek myth of Zeus's sexual abduction of Europa, whom he carries off across the sea on his back while disguised as a bull. Among these high-status deities, it's no surprise to find that Yahweh, too, was often understood as the divine bull. Bovine language, the Hebrew term Abir, underlies his biblical designation as the mighty one, Abir, of Jacob, who grants genital fertility to the Israelite tribe of Joseph. And in some biblical texts, Yahweh's cult statue is said to take the form of a bull or a bull calf. Like the Sumerian god Enki, Yahweh's status as a fertile creator god of the highest order is also confirmed in the Bible with a fleeting portrayal of his sexual encounter with the earthly realm. Although the biblical writers and their later translators have done their best to sanitize the story by diluting Yahweh's corporeal sexuality, its erotic features nonetheless suggest that an older myth lurks in the background. The God of the Bible sexually takes the land of Israel as his wife, as signalled by the euphemistic use of the verb to know, and excites the cosmos into an aroused, mutually reproductive fecundity as he impregnates his bride at a place called Jezreel, meaning he seeds, a region famed for its rich agricultural soils. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness, and you will know Yahweh. On that day, I will fructify, says Yahweh. I will fructify the heavens, and they will fructify the earth, and the earth will fructify the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they will fructify Jezreel, and I will seed her for myself in the land. In this poem in the book of Hosea, dated to about the 8th century BCE, Yahweh's penis may well be veiled from direct view, hidden behind a modesty screen of euphemism and wordplay, but the bodily, sexual connotations are impossible to miss. Like the prophets Isaiah and Ezekiel, who bear witness to Yahweh's genitalia, the prophet Hosea is well aware that God is equipped with a penis, and it's large enough and potent enough to arouse and fertilize the heavens and the earth. In the ancient cultures of Southwest Asia, a sizable penis, and even its occasional overt exhibition, did not render male deities less godly, but appropriately divine. The imposing erect virility of masculine gods was vividly celebrated in these ancient societies and the religious literature they produced. Although these texts often employ the slick euphemisms and clever wordplay of artfully crafted contemporaneous erotic compositions, there's nothing to suggest a cultural discomfort with the earthy, corporeal sexuality of male gods and their giant penises. Nor should these traditions be assumed to reflect a primitive worldview or an unsophisticated cause and effect nature religion, in which the sexual arousal of the gods mechanically stimulated the fecundity of the human environment. Indeed, these are views we owe as much to the xenophobic polemics of later Greek and Roman writers and artists, who preferred their cultural heroes to be modestly equipped with much smaller, civilized genitalia, as to the snobbish and orientalist theological disdain of later Western thinkers. Rather, the penises of ancient Southwest Asian gods embodied a conspicuous and powerful hypermasculinity deemed essential to the ordering, fruitfulness, and well-being of the cosmos and its inhabitants. It was a cultural phallocentrism with which we're still familiar today.